You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Yemen is rarely in the headlines, but it became a big story in connection with the failed suicide attack this past Christmas on a flight from Amsterdam to Detroit. That incident reminded the world of the important role the Southern Arabian Peninsula country plays in the global jihad movement. In her latest book, Yemen, Dancing on the Heads of Snakes, Victoria Clark, former correspondent and Moscow bureau chief for the London Observer, explains how it's become so central to the growth of contemporary jihadism. Her book is published by Yale University Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Ms. Clark to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Why do you go all the way back to the 16th century in order to explain Yemen's role in today's jihadist movement?
Well, I think I wanted to really try and give some idea of what Yemen is, what kind of color of a country it is, what makes it tick. And I particularly like history in all its forms. So it seemed to me a good way to begin was to say, this is a country with an incredible history of being invaded and misused by other nations. And I think that story really begins, at least in its modern period, in the 16th century.
Well, it's so far away from all those other places, but it still became part of the Ottoman Empire?
Yes, it did. And the Ottomans found it very important because it's actually quite near to Islam's holy places, Mecca and Medina, up the Red Sea coast. So, no, they thought it was quite important, but they never had a very good grip on it.
It's also close to the Horn of Africa, isn't it? Does that, you know, you can just go from Yemen into Africa, can't you?
Yes, it's very close, actually. It's only 18 miles across the what's called the Bab al-Mandeb, the Gate of Tears, is the sort of choke point there, which you would have to cross to get to the Horn of Africa.
The name of the drink mocha comes from a Yemeni town. Is Yemen still a place where coffee is grown?
Well, that's one of the sad things, really, about Yemen today is that, yes, the only place known very, very well in the world outside about Yemen outside to outsiders is Mocha, which is a Red Sea port from which coffee was shipped. In fact, it had the monopoly of the whole coffee trade.
And how did that change?
Well, what happened was the big powers, the big European empires, started growing coffee in their colonies. And through slave labor, of course, it became much cheaper to do it that way rather than rely on the Yemeni supplies. So it was a case of undercutting the market.
So is coffee a part of the current Yemenite economy?
Barely. I'm afraid not. I mean, if we can talk about a Yemeni economy, there's scarcely anything being produced in that country these days, and certainly very, very little coffee.
What about khat?
Khat, that is really what has taken over from coffee growing. Khat is this mild stimulant, much less strong than cannabis and certainly than alcohol, which is a social drug, really, if you want to say, look at it like that. It's used to oil the wheels of everything that goes on in Yemen society. So every afternoon, business deals are done over cat chews. The men sit down and chew for a good many hours, sometimes up to 6 hours a day. And this is being grown all over the country, and if you go to Yemen, it really looks like it's the only thing that's really moving and working is the production and distribution of khat.
Now, you say Yemen is the least understood of the Gulf states. Is that because it is hard for an outsider to understand or because people just don't go there and try to understand it?
Variety of reasons, I think. One being that it's a very poor country, as I say, which produces nothing that very much interests anybody else in the world. So, you know, from the point of simple hard cash point of view, it's not likely to excite much interest. The other thing is, of course, it's a very complicated place because it's been two countries until 1990, and each of those two parts of Yemen had different histories under different rulers.
caught up in Cold War politics.
Yes, straddling that divide, if you like. The south part of the country was the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen, capital Aden, under Soviet influence, but with a local homegrown Marxist rule. And the northern part, capital Sana'a, was more or less affiliated with the West, but of course getting all its weapons from the Soviet Union. Complicated, sitting on the fence, straddling both horses, kind of.
And is that something that is still in the minds of the Yemenites, that they were caught up in that? And, well, there's no Soviet Union anymore. What are their feelings about Russia today? What are their feelings about the United States and England? After all, you were born in Aden, weren't you, when it was a British colony?
Well, that's right. Yeah, this is a complicated story, a very rich and exciting and exotic one, but it can be complicated. So, yes, I was born in the what became the communist part, but for 128 years until 1830, from 1839 till 1967, was a British colony, Aden, with the two protectorates outside it. So quite a large area. And so in general, there is now a good feeling, remarkably a good feeling about British rule, perhaps in part because the period of communist rule was disastrous economically and a hard time. And what has happened since the unification of the country with the north part of Yemen has not been a happy story either. So amazingly, colonial rule looks attractive at the same time as there are a lot of people who are thinking that bin Laden looks quite attractive as well. So it's hard to imagine what kind of country this could be.
Well, on the one hand, you have, I'm sure, some people who became much more secular during the communist period. And then you have people who are extremely religious. There's also a small Shiite minority, but they're involved right now in a rebellion, aren't they?
Yes, that's a different story in that that's happening in the north, what used to be the north Yemen part of the equation, and up near the Saudi border. This is where the Shiite minority, it's about 35%, are up there, and they are rebelling in a way against central government. They don't like the fact that they've been sort of cut out of the division of goodies and various other grievances.
Well, that's been described as a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
I think that has been rather overstated. There's, for various reasons, various powers have had an interest in upping its profile as that. But actually, there has been no proof whatsoever that Iran is involved in that.
Is the concept of a unified Yemen just a formality? Because the way you describe it, it's really a collection of a lot of different kinds of people with different goals. And there's a kind of a tribal sensibility as well.
Yes, it is a complicated grouping of different interests and different regional priorities and different histories. On the other hand, it has to be remembered that these Yemenis have stood a better chance than most people in that area of being treated as seeing themselves as a nation, because they can look back at Muhammad's life and there is instances of him saying sort of faith is of the Yemenis, wisdom is of the Yemenis. He had a particular liking for Yemenis, so they take heart from that.
My guest is Victoria Clark, who's written a book called Yemen, Dancing on the Heads of Snakes. We'll explain that title a little later. It's published by Yale University Press. Why did it become a communist country just 1 year after the British left?
The communists took over, first of all, under the auspices of Nasser in Egypt as kind of Arab nationalists. But they took it one step further. Once Nasser was seen to be slightly shaky in his positions in Egypt, the local Arab nationalists in Yemen took communist ideas as
instead of joining the Arab Brotherhood.
Yeah, yeah. And so yes, it was the only country in the peninsula that actually went communist.
Do you think that the possibility Yemen will turn into an al-Qaeda state has been blown out of proportion?
Personally, yes, I do. I mean, on the face of it, there are so many reasons why you could say, oh, the signs are stacking up, this is a done deal, this is the most al-Qaeda likely place that you could ever imagine.
Well, it's become a recruiting ground for jihadists, hasn't it?
Yes, yes. And there are plenty of poor youths feeling that life hasn't got much to offer them in Yemen, wanting to strut on a bigger stage to make their lives meaningful. You can say all of that, but there are actually other things that make me think that Yemen won't be so easy. It's not going to fall into al-Qaeda's hands.
And why is that? Because there are people in Yemen who are anti-jihad?
Oh, plenty of people. Plenty of people. You know, certainly that is not a dominant enthusiasm among Yemenis, not for jihad and al-Qaeda, certainly not.
What about Osama bin Laden's role in all of this? Even though he was born in Saudi Arabia, isn't he seen by many Yemenis as Yemeni?
Yes, and I think it counts, the fact that his father comes from what used to be British ruled. It's the eastern part of Yemen today, an area called Hadramaut. A very remote and wonderful area for any visitor. I think bin Laden's homeland is a beautiful place to visit. So, yes, they would consider him a Yemeni through his father's ancestry.
Do you think that, or do you worry that the West might try to punish Yemen because of the increasing view that it is associated with al-Qaeda?
I think, actually, that the experiences of going into Afghanistan and Iraq have successfully inoculated the West against adventuring in that way. And there are very good logical reasons why you just don't want to mess in that direct, heavy-handed way in Yemen.
But you did meet with one of Osama bin Laden's former bodyguards. He's Yemeni?
Again, he comes also, his mother is from the same area as bin Laden's father came from. In fact, yes, both his parents come from former South Yemen.
And how did he get the job?
Well, he seems to have heard bin Laden speaking in Saudi Arabia. He's also from this group of exiled Yemenis living in Saudi Arabia after the communist takeover. That's a very important group of people who provided the actual core of al-Qaeda.
And then he joined Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan?
Yes, yes.
As a jihadist?
Yes.
And then why did he leave bin Laden? Why did he go back to Yemen?
As far as I know, as far as he told me, he fell out with some of the other followers and decided to strike out alone.
But he did justify the September 11th attacks.
Well, yes. Apparently at the time he wasn't so. He was shocked and thinking that bin Laden had overstretched himself. But by then he'd already separated from bin Laden in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm.
But did you find a lot of people sympathetic to the 9/11 attacks?
No. No, I didn't find people talking like that. I did find people very keen to go and fight Americans and Israeli troops. I don't know why they thought there would be Israeli troops on the ground in Iraq. That's what they felt would be viable. Most people did not at all like the idea of thousands of people dropping out of the Twin Towers to their deaths. That upset Yemenis.
Why would they even think that Israelis are in Iraq? Is this part of the kind of propaganda that people get in the press?
No, not in the press, but it's a rather sort of simple view of their fighting the Zionists and their allies, i.e. the US, Britain, and Israel. It's all one package. That's the enemy.
How did they view you as a British woman? Did they, when you told them that you were born in Aden, did that count for something?
Yes. I was viewed as an honorary Yemeni, which was delightful. And I must say, I felt very at home, especially in South Yemen. Despite the fact that my family left when I was two, I felt that that it was familiar territory for me. It was great to be there. And people were extremely nice to me. As a Western woman in Yemen, one is treated like a sort of third sex. You're neither male nor female. You get invited to eat with the men, and you may be sitting down with 20 men to eat. But there's no discomfort. I felt enormous courtesy.
In fact, you write about an incredible banquet from an unlikely source. We'll take a little break. We'll come back with more. My guest is Victoria Clark, who's written a book called Yemen, Dancing on the Heads of Snakes. It's published by Yale University Press. We're back with Victoria Clark, who's written a book called Yemen, Dancing on the Heads of Snakes. It's published by Yale. And you got the title for your book from something that the president of Yemen said?
That's right. The president has a way of telling all foreign journalists who he talks to that he sighs deeply and says, well, you know, what am I supposed to do? Ruling Yemen is like dancing on the heads of snakes. Which, when I first heard it, I thought, well, what kind of leader says that about his own people? I mean, snakes, that's quite rough. But I see what he means. It certainly is a good way of describing the way he rules the country. He's pretty nimble. He sees dangers and nimbly dances away from them.
Is that a reason he was elected? Do people see him as being nimble?
Elected, nothing. I mean, the way politics worked at the time that he was coming into power was far from that. He came in after two presidents had been assassinated within a year.
That makes it a dangerous job, doesn't it?
Extremely dangerous. There were two more attempts on his life when he did come in. This was a military. He was the third in the line of military rulers. And he has surprised everybody. People thought that he'd be out within a few weeks, given the precedence. But no, he's still there, 30 years, over 30 years now.
What is his position toward the jihadists?
Well, that has been viewed as pretty murky. People tend to think that it has suited him to dance on their heads as he would any other snakes, cajoling, bribing, bringing them into deals, putting them in jail, letting them out again, putting them in jail, letting them out again. This seems to have been the way that it's gone, which has upset, not quite understandably upset America very
well, because
badly.
He jails people with good reason and then lets them out. And what is the logic behind that? Do they feel that those people have been rehabilitated?
It's how he rules in every way. This is happening the whole time. He likes to be seen as a wise, just, kind, and generous sort of father figure. This is the template of how Arab rulers traditionally rule their tribes or their countries or whatever it is. And so it suits him to be seen as the merciful who can amnesty.
And what's the general feeling of the Yemenite public about him?
Admiring of his durability and of his cleverness, really, but also increasingly weary of the way he has run the country and the fact that things are really in a very, very bad way. Economically speaking, it's appalling. From the point of view of corruption, it's worse than appalling. The project of building the nation state of Yemen into something that looks like a modern nation state that anybody else would recognize seems to be failing, and that is necessarily upsetting for your average Yemeni who feels unprotected and unsupported.
Do they get outside aid from the West or from some of the wealthier of the Arab countries?
Yeah, there's a lot of, especially Saudi aid is the big one. There's quite a lot of British humanitarian aid. There's increasing amounts of American aid in that direction in an attempt to persuade would-be jihadists that there may be another sort of life possible. There is money going into projects that could encourage employment and industry and so forth. But it's a very, very steep hill to be scaled, you know, to pull Yemen out of its troubles.
And a listener asks, what can the international community do to alleviate the poverty?
I think that is one of the most appallingly difficult problems. Looking at Yemen, you don't know where to start with beginning to alleviate poverty.
Well, could they develop the agricultural sector again, or are there other natural resources?
I think that's not very realistic. Our best hope, I was at a conference in Washington yesterday discussing this, that could be to encourage Yemen's neighbors, who are the other rich Gulf countries, to open up their borders and allow Yemenis to come in, study, work, and set up this sort of remittance culture again, where money's flowing back into the country.
The failed suicide attack this past Christmas Day was traced back to Yemen. Was that a complicated process? Or was it pretty easy, just assume that jihadists would have been trained in Yemen?
No, I think he declared it himself, as far as I know, once he had been detained, that's where he'd got his bomb and got some of his training, yeah.
Well, why do you think Yemen's position in global jihadism wasn't taken seriously until recently?
I think there are a few reasons for that, and one of them is that, on the face of it, this president of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, has declared himself in alliance with the West against terrorism. So he's supposed to be our ally. It's a little bit embarrassing to have to point out, actually, you're running a nest of jihadism there. It's been tricky. Also, I think that Yemen is a very difficult place to get any facts and figures out of, to get any research done in. And so it would be easy to overlook it until something happens, and then you have to focus.
Well, when was the last time Yemen even made headlines in the West? It's been a while, hasn't it?
Well, as far as Americans are concerned, you'd have to go back to the year 2000, October 2000, when the big USS Cole warship was exploded in Aden Harbor. And you could say that was the first really big action Al-Qaeda had staged.
My guest is Victoria Clark. Her book, Yemen, Dancing on the Heads of Snakes, published by Yale University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Can we go back to the unification? That we have really two countries here for a while, and then it was unified in 1990?
That's it. I think just to really, you know, set the scene clearly, this Yemen people might feel that they are a coherent people, as the Prophet Muhammad described them. But as a nation functioning in a single state, there has never been such a thing that really looks convincing to anybody from outside.
Well, there have been any number of attempts to unify them before. What had prevented it from happening?
It was more that they dreamed of unification. But what happened was that European and the Ottoman empires were interested in that area strategically. And so the Ottoman Empire took the northern bit of it, and the Brits came in 1839, took Aden and a lot of the south.
And we have this wide range of influences from the Ottoman Empire, British common law, Islamic Sharia law, Marxist secularism. It's a rather volatile mix.
Yeah, very confusing. I mean, this is one traumatized country, you could say.
How was Yemen different after 1994 than it was before?
Well, that unification took place in 1990, mm-hmm. and it was done very quickly, very clumsily, and to nobody's satisfaction. And very soon, the southern Yemenis, who had been Marxists, decided that this wasn't working for them. They were in the minority in the new United Yemen, and it wasn't to their liking at all. And in fact, they decided that it would be rather good to divorce again. By 94, this was really underway. They'd always been a bit careful not to put all their eggs in one basket. The South had kept its own defense establishment separate from the North. You can imagine that's a recipe for trouble. And so in 1994, they actually had a two-month-long civil war between the two, what were the two halves of Yemen and supposed to be together. Well, the Northerners were better armed, bigger army and so forth. There really wasn't much question that they were going to prevail, and they did, and clamped down on the South again. And that has never worked. It just hasn't worked, and we're now 20 years on, and people are even more miserable than they were in 94.
They're surrounded by oil-rich countries. Do they have oil?
Very, very little. A trickle, and it's going to run out by about 2017.
You got to meet Yemen's best-known jihadist, Tariq al-Fakhil, who's a friend of Osama bin Laden. Why did he agree to not only meet you, but to serve you a very elaborate meal?
He is one of the most colorful and interesting characters in Yemen, I think. Tariq al-Fadli comes from the old ruling family of the Fadli tribe up the coast from Aden. It was a tribe that gave the British a lot of trouble throughout the British era. Charming Fadlis, but also troublesome and needing to be bribed a lot and paid off and rewarded with gifts and so forth. So that's the sort of background he came from. When the Brits pulled out and the Marxists took over, his dad was, the Sultan, was sent into exile in Saudi. And so Tariq, a three-month-old baby at the time of that takeover by the Marxists, grew up in Saudi, just like bin Laden. And I think, as far as I can understand, he grew up like any sort of Saudi teenager, bombing around in cars and a little bit disaffected and a little bit idle. And rumor has it, not rumor actually, a member of his family told me that Tariq wrapped a car around a lamppost one night in Saudi and decided, right, I've got to get out of the country. I don't want to go to jail. I'm going off to the jihad in Afghanistan. And once there, he covered himself with glory. Good fighter. Yemenis have a reputation in the region as very, very good fighters. Tariq was second to none. He met bin Laden there. Bin Laden was very alive to the fact that Tariq came from a big ruling family, the Fadli tribe, and so courted him assiduously. And, they were friends there. And then the idea of kicking the communists out of South Yemen appealed as a next step after kicking the communists out of Afghanistan. I'll go home, said Tariq. I'll go home to South Yemen and kick them out of my own homeland and take my ancestral land back. And this was a project that bin Laden was also quite keen on, but actually couldn't get enough support going. But Tariq was absolutely dead set on it, and he went home. And that's what he did in 94.
He engaged in the fighting.
He engaged in kicking the communists out in that civil war of 94. He saw that unification had meant that the communists somehow were still in power in the South, and so agreed with the Northern president, I'll work with you to kick them out. And so he was on the side of the Northern president, but when I first met him in 2004, it was clear that he was losing respect for the Northern president and deciding that actually the best thing to happen would be for the South to become independent again.
With him as a leader?
With him as a leader. And so he is now a leading figure of the independence struggle and looking quite promising as a leading figure there. Yeah.
And he can't be arrested?
at the moment, the president doesn't want to make him into a martyr, it would appear. So he's sort of sitting in his house in the small town outside Aden with his 17 kids and his four Islamically permitted wives, and just keeping a fairly low profile.
Why do you think he was so gracious to you? After all, you do represent the enemy.
Well, that's a very strange thing, because obviously by the time that I met him, he was thinking, my poor homeland has been through communism, we've had rule from the northern Yemenis, we don't like that. He was looking back to the British time, like so many southern Yemenis, and thinking maybe this was the time when there was order.
The United States had a certain blowback with all of the arms that they supplied to the people fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan. Those arms have been used against the United States since. Should we be wary about sending arms to Yemen to fight the jihadists?
I think that would be a very, very bad idea. The country is already bristling with arms, far too much weaponry. There are reputed to be three guns per Yemeni in that country already. So the last thing that Yemen needs is more weaponry.
Just one other thing. A listener asks about Shabam in Yemen, which he says is referred to as Manhattan of the Desert.
Yes, that is a splendid place, not far from where bin Laden's dad comes from, actually. And yes, it rises out of absolutely nothing, desert. These 10, 12-story skyscrapers built of mud blocks, dried.
So these are ancient skyscrapers?
Yeah, they've been there for 500 years. But easy to repair. You just make a few more mud blocks and slot them in where they're needed. And half of them tend to be white. I think it's the top half that's white and the lower half that's just mud color. It's a very, very striking place, and they're marvelous, marvelous sights in Yemen.
So this could be a great tourist attraction if Yemen could get its act together.
Certainly it could be. It's definitely the most exotic and unexpected place I've ever been.
Victoria Clark is a former correspondent and Moscow bureau chief for The Observer. She now works as a freelance journalist and a writer, contributing to the London Times, Independent, the BBC World Service, Radio 4, Prospect Magazine, and her book, Yemen, Dancing on the Heads of Snakes, is published by Yale University Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.